This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. The content shared is not a substitute for professional medical, mental health, legal, or financial advice. Please consult a qualified professional for personalized guidance or treatment. By listening, you acknowledge that the hosts and guests are not responsible for any decisions or actions you take based on this content.
Feel like a grouch, go beyond the couch, share your confessions on the Aurora Sessions.
Hello, Aurora Healing Crew. Welcome to the Aurora Sessions Beyond the Couch, where we take the stressors that come up in session and bring them into conversation beyond the couch. This is the space where real talk meets real life. Hi, everyone. It's Teresa. I'm the founder of Aurora Sun Counseling, a group private practice providing psychotherapy for clients in New Jersey, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. Here with me is my good friend, Michelle. Can you tell everybody what you do and why I wanted you to be here?
Yes. Hi, I'm Michelle Fecht. As Teresa said, I'm one of her good friends. She's a very good friend of mine, and I've been grateful for her friendship. Professionally, I am a licensed professional counselor, which is an LPC. And in Pennsylvania, I'm a licensed behavior specialist. And I'm also a certified in child and adolescent anxiety. And I work during the day. I work at a middle school providing therapy services to students who qualify through their IEP for those services. And then at night, some nights, I also have a private practice. So primarily, I work with adolescents and teens, probably 10 to 17 range age.
Can you tell me about why you became a therapist?
So it's kind of interesting because when I was growing up, it was all about being a teacher. No one could tell me otherwise. I had a fake classroom in the basement with a chalkboard my dad had bought at a yard sale. I had a fake teacher name. I had all the things. I went to college and got to my senior year of college, just about ready to graduate. And I had the thought of, oh crap, I don't want to be a teacher. And what had changed my mind so drastically was at the time, my brother, who is only 14 months younger than me, was struggling with substance abuse and mental health issues. My parents were always grateful to have had us because they went through 7 years of infertility in the 70s. And then out of nowhere, they ended up having 3 children in 3.5 years. So be careful what you wish for is what they always said. So my younger brother is only 14 months younger than me. My older brother is only 2.5 years older than me. So we were all very close in age. So you had 3 teenagers at one time. My younger brother from the beginning was different. In the early 80s, we didn't really know much about why he was different. We just knew he was different. He had his own language that most people could not understand. Being only 14 months older than him, I was kind of like his translator. So people would ask him a question and they would have no idea what he said. So I would be beside him like, oh, he wants peanut butter and jelly or, oh, he needs a drink, because he just couldn't understand him, which now we know. And he was diagnosed later with apraxia, which is a speech and language disorder where you can't coordinate your tongue, lips and mouth and jaw to produce sounds. So when he went to preschool, the teachers at that preschool told my parents, you need to get him evaluated. Now, this is 1983, so that tells you how significant this would have been at the time. So they did, and he qualified for services right off the bat. He went to intermediate schools. Me and my older brother went to Catholic school. My younger brother could not go there because of his disabilities at the time, so they sent him out of district. He couldn't even go to our local school at the time. So he was in special education, but in more like self-contained life skills type class, because he was, you know, he had the apraxia, but he also had learning disabilities, challenges with reading and writing, but smart as anything. I mean, he was brilliant. So as time went on, when he was about 17, he got diagnosed with autism. It was about that time, 98, that was starting to become more diagnosed,
which is so interesting because now the diagnosis is earlier.
Yes.
As we know more about autism and what it looks like.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And even then, we didn't know what it was. So my parents didn't even know he had autism because it wasn't really explained. It wasn't until I got my degree that I started going, hey, mom, dad, I think David has autism, because the signs were all there, the apraxia, the difficulty speaking. He would line his cars up around the house in like this order around the house. He lost track of time. He had trouble with social connections, inferences, like just a lot of things. He would play on his own a lot in his own little world. So there were a lot of, all the signs were there. It's just in the 80s and early 90s, that just wasn't something, you know, we knew autism as nonverbal individuals at that time and didn't realize the broad spectrum of what it is today.
Right.
So he was more diagnosed with just severe learning disabilities, apraxia, and that was it at the time. So anyway, so as I was going through college, we also had some things go on in our teen years that were difficult for us as a family, that me and my brother were there for each other for. And I just thought when I got to my senior year of college, like, I want to be the me that we needed. And teachers are great. Teachers are there for their kids. I'm not saying that, but I had a good guidance counselor in high school that helped me along. And I thought, you know what? I want to do that. I think I'm going to change focus and do that.
That's great.
Yeah.
So was it difficult to switch majors at the time?
I didn't switch majors. I did graduate with the education degree.
Okay.
But when I graduated, I went and became a social worker, case manager in mental health, instead of going into teaching. And then I did that job, I got my master's.
Got it. Oh, that makes sense. Okay. Yeah. And that is actually something that I say to people too, that usually the career picks us and we don't pick the career.
Yes.
So,
and I don't think it was, I mean, I don't know about you, but I was raised in a very like, I lived in a row home, blue collar. I'm the first college graduate on my mom's side, I think second on my dad's. So it wasn't like being a therapist was a role that we heard about. You know, I heard about accountant because I was good at math. I heard about teaching. I heard about being a lawyer. But I don't think anyone said, hey, you should be a psychologist.
Right.
You should be a therapist one day. You know what I mean? I don't think
and
it was pushed.
The steps to take, like what classes, what's the major, what do you have to do to get your degree?
Yeah. And so, I think it's more common now. I don't think when we were growing
for
up.
For sure.
Yeah.
I also say that I think having a therapist is trendy right now.
It's more of a career path. I think COVID helped people realize the value of mental health.
Yes, for sure. So your brother helped you, guide you in your career path. So can you tell me about, I guess, family dynamics and how that affected you and what your family had to go through having an undiagnosed.
Yes. So around, I would say around the early 90s, so when my brother was about 12, 13, at the time, there was a push to for inclusion, which is a great thing. Not, you know, but in 1992, I don't think people were ready for it or understood individuals like my brother David. Now, teachers are trained in that. So when they did that in middle school, unfortunately, I don't think that it was the good fit for him.
Mm-hmm.
So he was in special education for math and reading, I believe, and then regular classes for the other ones. But the problem was, you know, he couldn't keep up. He fell behind. He started not wanting to go to school, feeling stupid, feeling insecure, feeling like he didn't belong, that he couldn't get it. Like, he just really, insecurity really started popping its head up in the middle school years. So he started avoiding school and not going, and there would be horrible fights to try and get him to go. And if you work with children, I mean, it's really hard to send them to a place you know is upsetting.
Mm-hmm.
Some things were not great. He was called lazy, unmotivated, stupid. One teacher that we both had, because we're a year apart, actually said, "Why can't you be smart like your sister in math? Mm. Your sister was so good at math. Why are you good at math?" And he came home and he told me about it and he was so upset. So, you know, it was the early 90s. Things were a little different. I'm glad we've made some progress. But when you're not good at school and you don't feel comfortable at school and you're not really good at sports, and you're dealing with this speech issue and this learning issue and autism, and you're dealing with depression and anxiety, sometimes, you know, someone might offer you some drugs, marijuana or cigarettes, and you try it because, you know, whatever. And I think that was the beginning of him kind of learning how to cope with all of the things that were going on in his mind at the time.
And how old around?
I think he started smoking marijuana at 12.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I believe 12, 13.
Mm-hmm.
And it progressed. It wasn't like right off the gate an addict. I don't think anyone chooses that. I don't think anyone goes, you know what? I think I'm just going to go all out. And I think that's the misconception, is that it's a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Or that people are choosing it. I think in the beginning, for most addicts, it's just fun or a way to escape.
Mm-hmm.
And
a coping skill.
A coping skill.
To get through the bullies at school,
right.
The fights, feeling dumb.
Right. And too often, the bullies that my brother dealt with were adults.
Mm.
And I'll be fair about that. And that, because I don't think a lot of people understood him. And they mistook his shyness or his wanting to retreat or wanting to escape the noise as defiance. So fast forward, the first time my brother overdosed, I believe I was 16 and he was 15. It wasn't like a real overdose. A friend of his had Ritalin for their ADD. And they all took it.
Right.
And my brother had a bad reaction and ended up in the hospital. So my parents did the right thing immediately. He went to rehab. We did the meetings. We did family therapy at the time. So kudos to them. Even in the 90s, they went and got their kid help.
Right.
Which is probably
and family
really
therapy.
Hard to do. Yeah.
Right.
So then, you know, he still struggled, did not want to go to school. School was not a place he wanted to be. And he really wasn't like a problem in the community or anything. He kind of just stayed to himself. He had really good friends that were accepting and there for him. Then he moved to Florida with my father. He did get services down in Florida. They re-identified him as needing self-contained classes.
So like 15, 16 years old.
So he's 17.
Oh, okay.
So that's when he got diagnosed with the autism.
Right.
And then they said this student shouldn't be in regular education, like a life skills.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Independent living, preparing
you for life type of program. So they switched him back, which would have been great. However, it was almost too late because he was 17 at the time. He had turned 18. The school up in PA did not transfer his credits because he never finished ninth grade. So then they told my brother he would go school until he was 21 at that point, or 20 instead of graduating at 19. And my brother, he was 18. He was like, I'm done. You just put up one more roadblock.
Right.
I'm done.
So between the overdose to 19 or 17, did he continue to experiment?
I'm not sure. I mean, I know, yeah, probably. But it was mostly just weed, really, right, throughout high school. Maybe some Ritalin. He wasn't a drinker.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't good, but he was still him and doing, you know, just wasn't going to school. But he was the kindest, sweetest person you've ever met. So I guess around when he was about 21, 22 is when he started getting into more riskier substances. I think the whole school thing, like having to essentially drop out because they put another year onto his thing, threw him through a loop, because I think he thought at that time he was doing good. He had a path. He was going to graduate. He was going to go tech. Like, I think he thought he had a handle on some things and saw the end of the tunnel of the school thing. And then when they put that roadblock up, I feel like that threw him into almost like a, I give up. I do know he started heroin on accident. He thought he was smoking a joint, and it wasn't. Yes, so that was an accident. He never would have. I mean, who knows? But
right. Him. Well, that's also one of the risks that we teach young people is one, marijuana isn't the marijuana that your grandparents smoked, and also you never know what is in it.
What is in
yeah.
it? And something clicked in him, and it was like, this is the best thing I've ever felt. And I think he thought you know, like anybody who starts it, like, I'm fine. I'm not going to get addicted. Like, it's going to be fine. There's a lot to be learned from this whole process. And for the audience to know, my brother did pass away March 17th of 2025, probably about, let's see. So he was 43. So we're talking almost 30 years of using substances. Not all of those were active addiction years. There were some sober years in there, some good years in there, some not so great years in there.
So when he was sober, what do you think was the most helpful to keep him? What did he do that kept him sober?
I think when he was sober, so the first time he got clean was after several years of some really difficult addiction. And that kind of happened with, we finally got him on Medicaid, which was a big deal. And he was qualified for Medicaid through mental health, not substance abuse, not autism at the time, because in this process, my brother was also diagnosed with PTSD from a trauma that he had as a child. He also was diagnosed with major depression and anxiety. He qualified for Medicaid. So once we got him on Medicaid and we're able to get him insurance, I guess he might have been like 25 at the time, 24, 25, somewhere around there. We were able to get him services. We got him a case manager. He was able to get onto methadone, which is a medically assisted treatment for those who become addicted to opiates. You can't get high.
Harm reduction.
Thank you. We got him on that, and we got him some counseling. We got him therapy. Went to rehab. We took him to meetings. We did all the things, and he did pretty okay for like probably like a year and a half, you know, about that time. And then, to be honest, since then, he hadn't touched heroin in like 20 years. So, I mean, that actually did work.
Right.
But the issue I find that made him go to other things is the mental health aspect. We treated the substance abuse, but we never were able to get the treatment for the underlying issues. And that's where I think we're messing up.
Okay. So circling back to getting qualified for disability, we're talking about permanent disability through the state.
Yes.
And in order to get permanent disability through the state hires, you have to go to a psychiatrist or provider that the state approves, and they put all the symptoms and everything, and then the court decides
yes.
that he's permanent disabled, which means that he can't function enough or be able to have a full-time job.
Right.
And then because of that, because we live in the United States, our health insurance depends on our jobs. So therefore, he qualified for Medicaid as well. And then that's how he was able to get services.
Right. And to be clear, because there's a lot of controversy about it, my brother got it on the first shot.
Oh, that's amazing.
Nobody gets it on the
first shot. No, not for mental health especially.
So that tells you a lot
yes.
of what they saw at the time mm-hmm. and his whole childhood.
Yes.
I mean, it's not like he just was always different and,
yes.
And needed a lot of support.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout his whole life, he needed support. And I think that's how he turned to addiction, is that support was taken away
mm-hmm.
when he was moved to a different education program. He lost that support. And then when we gave it back to him, it was almost too late. Like, if I had to go back in time, I would tell parents, like, make sure you're fighting for the support your kids need and don't take no for mm-hmm. an answer of what you think they need, because my parents fought that. And we're like, we don't think he should be in those classrooms. And the school said, no, this is what we're doing. So I think, you know, advocating for your family and being present is one way that families really can help their loved one who is, or not families, spouses, whoever, friends, can help their loved one with accessing services or helping get their needs met. Because I think that helped a lot once we got, because before that period, I couldn't get him in anywhere without insurance. Forget it. Mm-hmm. There was one place, it was like $750 a month or something at the time. I remember calling and I was like, my brother's really struggling, but he doesn't have insurance. So we were really glad when he got it, and it really helped the financial burden for my parents and, for him. And that helped for a little while. But again, at the time, and even now, there's not a lot of focus on co-occurring disorders. It's like we're treating mental health and substance abuse as two separate things, and they're separate from medical. And it's like, really, we should be doing all three because they are connected. And that's kind of what the issue was for a long time. So we would kind of go in a circle where we would find a place to help him, but they'd say, well, we can't. We don't have the license to prescribe his methadone if he comes here. So he can't come here unless mm-hmm. he gets off the methadone, which if you need to get off methadone,
it's in your bones.
You need to detox.
Yes.
So you can't like that to get help. It would take months. And then if we went to a drug and alcohol place, they would say, well, he can't be on these psych meds that he's prescribed. So he have to be off those.
So for those who don't know, and I'm curious too, why did they say he couldn't be on psych meds in those substance abuse
So
programs?
Some of the psychiatry medications he was on could be abused.
Got it.
Like
gabapentin, people don't like.
Gabapentin.
Yes.
That's a new one that people need to be aware of.
Mm-hmm.
Not new, but a newer one that's being abused.
Correct.
Benzos can be abused. Seroquel can be
right.
abused. So these were some of the ones he was on that a halfway house or a rehab would say he can't come here on them.
Yes.
Which was very frustrating because it's like, but he needs
both
of these medications or these medications. And you're, so where do I put him?
Mm-hmm.
And this was me, his sister, going around in the circles trying to navigate the system. And I'm in the field.
Mm-hmm.
So I know what to ask.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought like, gosh, imagine if they didn't have like these families who don't have someone who knows how to navigate this. Yeah, so it was quite difficult to find a place that could take all three.
But that's the one thing that I keep thinking about. One is like, because you and your brother were only 16 months apart, 14 months apart, you answered from him when he couldn't speak to all the way till pretty much the day he passed, you were his advocate. Like, how lucky was he and your whole family that he had someone in the field a sister, twin, Irish twins, as we call it, and to be there. And I can't imagine for the people who don't have a twin advocating in the field for someone, because a lot of part of the stigma of mental health and substance abuse is that it is a choice. You're weak if you get help. And meanwhile, the system, even in the industry, the system itself are fighting against each other.
Mm-hmm. They're passing. There were many times each system was passing my brother to the other.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is your problem. This is yours. This is not ours. He went to a hospital in December of 2024. I won't say the name. He went there. It was up in North Jersey, and he was at a rehab. And then he went to the hospital for something medical. And then the hospital went to send him back to the rehab. And the rehab said, we don't take people with autism. I filed complaints. I filed appeals. I filed things with boards. And it's just, I feel like it's just... For me, that was what I could do. Mm-hmm. I couldn't fix him. I knew mm-hmm. I couldn't fix him. He had to want it too. I mean, there's mm-hmm. a part of that too. You can want to be clean, but if there's so many barriers put up to you that don't even help you to get there, it's so hard.
Right.
Like, I can't imagine what he felt every day.
Mm-hmm.
Like, not wanting to do this thing, mm-hmm. but your body makes you do this mm-hmm. thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And there's... I think, again, with the co-occurring disorders, my brother, isn't it, as a child, was someone who perseverated, ruminated, and fixated on things, like just kept talking and talking about them. It was part of how he presented with autism. And then you take that with addiction that also makes you do that.
Right.
And it's like this storm. And we to find treatment that can do that. It's so hard to address yes. all three things. Like, it's almost it's like a unicorn.
Correct. And when you have that little moment where you're seeing clear and you want to get sober, and then all those barriers between mental health, substance abuse, money, not having access, the legal system, it's a wonder anybody
does it, right?
And he had you and your family.
Yeah, and he had a very supportive family. We, my dad, mom, my older brother, and I, we never turned our backs. We might have gotten mad. We might have yelled. I always said to my brother, I said, you know, I don't love the things you do, but I love you. And that'll never change. Like, I know this is not you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can separate the two. But you need to get it together. Like, you need to do better, and I'll help you do that. Like, I've sent him to hospitals. I set up things. I got him pulled strings for places. Like I said, filed complaints. I would file appeals with his insurance company. And keep in mind, my brother lived in three different states, and all three states had the same barriers.
Mm-hmm.
Some worse than others. I will say, he went to one hospital in...
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Florida. Took me months to find him to get into this place because it was really difficult down there. Got him in, and then he was discharged because they lost their funding and had to get rid of 7 beds.
Oh my gosh.
And he was one of the newer ones, so they kicked him out. So there's just a lot of things that were like, you take like an inch and then they put like a mile further in front of you. And if you took all the times my brother went to detox or to a mental health hospital for 5 days, because that's typically what he would get, 5 to 10 days
mm-hmm.
at most, very rarely any more than 10. Try curing 30 years of mental illness and drug addiction in 10 days. But if you took all those 5 to 10 days stays over 30 years, you could have given him a year of treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why are we just not doing mm-hmm. what we know works? Mm-hmm. Why are we hoping we give a little and that'll fix when mm-hmm. we know proven over and over and over again that does not work.
Right.
Right. And the other issue is my brother would go to IOP.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the other thing that he would get.
Which is intensive outpatient.
Intensive outpatient. But there would be so many people with his anxiety and his autism. He couldn't be there. He would get claustrophobic and panicky, and he'd want to leave, which could be, you know, part of the avoidance too. But those programs didn't fit him, is the point. They weren't the thing that was going to work. The thing that would have worked for my brother would have been like a year, like a long-term program with structure and routine every day, have it kind of being really doing the work of therapy, intensive skill training, job training, like all those things would have been what probably could have helped him. Instead, what we got was 3 days here, five days here, 7 days here, 10 days here, and you're on a waiting list for that, and a waiting list for this, and a waiting list for that. And that just, over time, just makes you give up.
Yes. Few questions. One, what do you want families to know now who might be struggling with a young adult going through this? Where can they get help? What should they do?
I think it's important to, when we're talking to young teens, even elementary, I mean, I would even go even earlier, because I think we teach them about what drugs and alcohol and smoking does to your body physically, right? All the commercials that we see with the really graphic medical stuff. Where I think we're lacking is that we're not teaching them that the risks of being an addict. Like, if you have a mental health condition or autism, I think I saw from a study in Cambridge, like 3 times more likely to become an addict. If you have a parent that was an addict, you're like 8 times likely to become an addict. If you have any kind of trauma in your background, if you have, you know, struggles in school, or you just, something just happened that was really difficult for you, like all these risks, like just know, like you and your friend could both smoke weed, and your friend, if they don't have those risks, they might be fine. They might not become an addict. But with your background, your genetics, or your, you know, if you have someone in your family who's an addict, or throughout your generations, trauma can be passed down and everything, like you might be at risk for that. And I think we're missing that piece of it, of telling the kids of what in them that they might not know about can make them more likely to become one. Not that they will. It's not a guarantee. I'm not an addict, right? Me and my brother were raised by the same people. But the also thing is like the why. Like if you're using a substance, alcohol, vaping, weed, whatever, and you're doing it because you're upset or something bad happened that day, you got a bad grade, your boyfriend dumped you, or you're having a fight with your friends or your parents, and you're like, you know what? I need this to calm down. Or like if everything just feels so hectic and you're using it, that's a red flag.
Yeah.
Right?
Using it as what we call a maladaptive coping skill.
Right. Right. And I think that's what my brother learned very young, is like something bad would happen, he'd go, you know, smoke
versus a joint. Which is the better way to use? I'm kidding.
So, versus, you know, but that's kind of how it started.
Right.
And I don't think most people realize that.
Yeah.
And it's like the importance of why am I using this? Like
the intention.
What is the emotion I'm feeling when I'm grabbing this thing? And I think that's where we have to teach not just kids and even adults, you know, so it's like the, why are you grabbing it?
Right. Am I trying to avoid a feeling? Am I trying to, cope with something? Am I trying to not feel my grief?
Right.
Am I not enjoying life right now?
So I think that's important. Like parents, teachers, people, and even for yourself, like, why am I grabbing this and what are my risks? Make it more personalized to every child or teen, of like, not just like, hey, you can end up with lung cancer or something. Cause that just, they feel invincible. That feels so far away, right?
So it sounds like even people with diagnosis, or like people who have IEPs, I think in general, it would be good to educate parents and kids that, like you said, that you are more likely to have these things happen. I think the hard part is having these kids believe that these things are actually going to, might happen.
Right.
Because we're just old people talking to them.
Right. Yeah. But I also think it's hard for parents to think it could happen to their kid.
Yeah, true.
You know, I'm not naive. You know, I'm in the field, you're in the field. I've taught my children about addiction. They know about my brother. I've been very honest, you know, age-appropriate honest throughout the years. And it could still happen to them. Like, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. So I think you can't think that it's... And I think that's the other issue. I'm getting kind of off topic right now, but... How else you can help families that are going through this is to be there. Mm-hmm. Treat the family that is dealing with mental health, substance abuse, as you would if they had a family member with cancer, mm-hmm. right? Check in with them. Make mm-hmm. them a dinner. Ask them how they're doing. Ask them how their loved one is doing. You know, like, you don't have to, no one can fix it, right? But you could still kind of just acknowledge that they're going through this thing because... It's, I think as a family, you become silent,
mm-hmm.
right? Because there's such a stigma and there's embarrassment and there's pain. And, you know, for a while, I didn't talk about it at all.
Mm-hmm.
No one knew my brother was an addict. I mean, people knew he was different because we mm-hmm. grew up with a lot of people. But for a long time, I didn't tell a lot of people about what was going on. I mean, there was a time I was a social worker where I was on one floor helping my client, a child or whatever, taking an appointment. Then I'd go down to the bottom floor where my brother was, check on him, help him get services. Then I'd go back up and not tell a soul.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, no one even knew that I was like doing mm-hmm. that. So I think for families, it's okay to talk about. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be embarrassed. Mm-hmm. You don't have to feel like you did anything wrong. And take everyone's advice with a grain of salt, you know? Mm-hmm. There was a lot of kick them out, throw them on the street, let them mm-hmm. hit rock bottom. And that might have worked for some people. But my brother had autism and other challenges that would not make that a good choice. So, you know, people, they're going to tell you what to do and what not to do.
So if they're in school, if they have a school-aged child, would they go to their guidance counselor?
Yeah, go to their guidance counselor. Most schools have what's called a student assistance program mm-hmm. right now, and that normally deals with vaping, smoking, drugs, and alcohol, and mental health. If your school does have a school psychologist, you could go to them. Or if your child does have an IEP, they might have a case manager that mm-hmm. can link you to things. Some schools have school social workers that can connect you with Medicaid or insurance or outside providers if you need that.
So what do you think about NAMI? Is NAMI one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, NAMI is a good one. Any reputable, you know, organization that's out there mm-hmm. doing the work, really.
So the other question I had as a therapist, one of the things that I talk to the people in the practice, and it comes from the trauma-focused CBT training that I had, in every... supervision, we had to talk about what were we doing for self-care, mm-hmm. like practice what we preach. And it didn't matter how long that took. She made us all talk about what we were doing for self-care. So what did you do and what do you do now to kind of help you continue to be a therapist, to be there for your clients and the kids that you see?
That's an interesting question. So it depends on what decade. No, I'm kidding. So, you know, originally, like I said, I wouldn't tell anyone about it. You know, there's this whole idea that therapists shouldn't self-disclose, mm-hmm. right? So I just, you know, when you're young, you just hit the ground running, mm-hmm. you know, and you're just like trying to figure out your way and just act like you have everything under control. At least that's what I did. I don't mm-hmm. know if other people do that, but over time.
Well, we didn't talk about it.
We didn't talk about it.
So we don't know.
Like, you're, you know, you should just, you know.
Suck it up
and do 20 million jobs, like as a social worker, and just keep it on, right, until you get burnout. And burnout was almost like the acceptable thing, you know, how it was in the early days. Yes. It's like, if you don't get burned out, you're not doing your job.
Correct. You don't care enough.
You don't care enough. You need to be burnt out. Like, you need this to be your life. You know, and that only takes you so far. I think as you get older, you learn more the balance. I'm very good at doing the job and going home. But what I do love to do, I read.
Mm-hmm.
I love my gardening.
Mm-hmm.
And I love my birds.
Oh, geez.
I have my video yes. birdhouse that I watch. And I color, oddly. I try to stay off my phone. And that's an addiction too, right?
It is.
So I color. Like if I keep my hands busy, that helps. I work out. I try to go for walks and things. You try to do what you can. And I'll be honest, you know, everyone thinks therapists have it all together. We mm-hmm. struggle just as much as anybody else.
Yes.
That's okay.
And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do this podcast, because
yeah.
we're all in it. We're all human. We're all going through something. So
right. You want someone whose house has been on fire and they know how to put it out.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean the house doesn't go on fire every now and then,
mm-hmm.
but you want someone who's been through it to know how to put it out, you know? And I also had to work on with my brother and my family of not always being the firefighter.
Yes. Boundaries. Boundaries is one of the reasons why Michelle and I are such good friends, because we balance each other out. And when it makes me feel good when I have to tell her to watch her boundaries, but she's the first one to tell us what's okay and what's not okay.
So. I don't have, Teresa knows that I struggle with boundaries. I feel like I could fix everything with just a little bit of grit, or I could just do everything. And I'm getting better with,
yes.
with that. The last 2 years, I think I've gotten a lot better with just kind of like reading my energy or my gut.
Mm-hmm.
And listening to it instead of rationalizing things, you know,
because yes.
I think that's also the downside of being a therapist, is that you could see all sides of everything. Right. And sometimes you give too many
reasons.
Thank you.
Yes. Well, it's all part of ACT, which I learned in the intuitive eating and binge eating anti-diet certification, that we all have parts,
mm-hmm.
the self part, the firefighter, and the manager.
Mm-hmm.
So when the firefighter's going and it's like flaring.
Wait, that's a real thing. Is it
like our parts? Yes.
Oh, wow.
And
I never knew that.
And
yeah.
the goal is to get as close to our feeling of self mm-hmm. as much as possible. So like gardening, coloring, reading, mm-hmm. petting our dogs,
mm-hmm.
that cuddling with our children or partners or whatever, that helps us get to our sense of self
mm-hmm.
when our manager is overmanaging and when our firefighter is overreacting.
Yeah, that's where I'm at. Like,
yeah.
I said that to my father and my older brother. My mom, for the listeners, has been deceased for 10 years. One of the things I tell people is, you know, my dad, my brother and I, we're like, we wish my brother was still alive, who,
mm-hmm.
by the way, had passed from a heart attack,
mm-hmm.
From damage from years of drug abuse and just genetics too.
Mm-hmm.
Cause my mother passed from a heart attack. So what can you do once it happens? Like, you know, we fought to prevent this outcome for so long
mm-hmm.
as a family, 30 years of just trying to prevent this,
mm-hmm.
right? And living on the edge of your seat, waiting for that phone call
mm-hmm.
for the 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a day that ever my parents would call me and I wouldn't think it was for,
mm-hmm.
for that reason, for him being deceased. And now that that's gone,
mm-hmm.
right? It's like, what do you do? Well, I do this. I'm going to try and educate people and teach people how this happens and how to be more supportive and empathetic and compassionate to those that are going through it, because there are a lot of barriers. It's not a matter of will all
no.
the time. And families that are going through it need support, you know, because we're often isolated and alone and just kind of dealing with it with our heads down. And to tell families, you don't have to deal with it with your head down. You can reach out. And the other thing is, now that my brother is gone, is to heal,
mm-hmm.
right? Because now we can go forward and kind of deal with everything that we've been through, because
mm-hmm.
we're no longer putting out fires.
One more question that pops in is, what happens with, like, a lot of people say tough love
mm.
and with addiction and boundaries, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like how to set boundaries and codependency
mm-hmm.
and when to like help, when to not help. And one of the things that I think that you've said that's really important is that it's all almost like an IEP. Every person is different. Their recovery mm-hmm. is different. I would say in addition to that, the family members, a great thing to do is for them to also maybe get help,
yes.
get a therapist,
yes.
not just support groups.
No.
There's also Al-Anon yes. For families.
And Nar-Anon.
Yes.
Yes, that's important. We have struggled with that, all of us, and my parents specifically. I think parents have a harder time with that than siblings. But the to not give in, I guess, or to not enable, which is extremely hard. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think sometimes when parents or family members do give in, people judge them for it.
Yes.
People aren't living the life of having their child, you know, need something. You know?
And I think that's the hard part about people sharing, because even though we want to talk about it, find people to help support us, when we share, we're afraid of judgment.
Yeah, we don't want the, you know, and it's like judgment or just advice that, you know, that wouldn't, that you tried or it didn't work and it's not that easy. And that's okay. But I think, you know, telling people something like, hey, look, I just need you to listen. I don't need advice.
Yeah.
I just need to vent about what's going on with my person in my life. You know, in Nar-Anon and Al-Anon, you call it a qualifier, my qualifier, mm-hmm. right? Because it could be a friend. It could be anyone.
Right.
So, you know, I just need you to listen. I don't need advice, right? I'm in this situation that doesn't have a easy solution. So I just had a horrible night, right?
Yes.
One of the worst nights or scary nights of yes. my life. I just need to talk to someone. I don't yes. need a solution. You know, that's important to reach out to people. You know, and you don't even have to tell them every detail. I went from one end where I told people nothing, then sometimes I told them too much. It's just whatever, you know, and give yourself permission to just lose
be
it.
Human.
Yeah, be
yes,
human.
Be human.
And you're going through something so challenging that it's a unique experience to everybody. Mm-hmm. Nobody's, when someone's dealing with an addict, no, everybody's story is so different,
mm-hmm.
but also the same. So I think reaching out is good. Going to Nar-Anon, I've done it. I've also gone to Al-Anon through the years is also good because they do a very good job at teaching boundaries and also what you do and do not have power or control over, and to recognize that, and that not to take a lot of people who are mentally ill or addicts, like their behavior personally, you know what I mean? And not engage. Or
not taking responsibility
right,
for other
not,
people's behaviors.
Right, exactly. And it does a really good job at that. It's hard. It's hard not to take responsibility or try mm-hmm. to fix it. But that's kind of where I was at the last couple years with my brother. Like I would help him set up services. I would help talk to him. I would send him places. But then if he was engaging in some of that, I'd cut it off. Like,
okay.
you know what
yeah.
I mean? Like I love
you.
You
had to set boundaries.
Yeah, like, I love
I think
you.
That's important for people to
I
hear
love you.
Too.
Like,
yep.
I know this isn't true. I'm not going to go back and forth with you, you know, and kind of do that kind of talk. What I call firm and friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Firm and friendly. Like you could be firm, but friendly. You don't
yes.
have to be firm and mean, right? You could be firm and friendly. You know, and I think that there's a lot of support and information out there now for people than there was when my family started this journey.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's, I think if anything good came out of COVID is the normalization of mental health
mm-hmm.
In a way. So I think that's changing the tides, and I hope people are less isolated
mm-hmm.
families that are going.
Okay. So is there anything last minute things that you wanted to share to everybody before we end?
I think the main thing is, for teens and adolescents and children, I think it's really important that when you know you have a child who has challenges
mm-hmm.
or is just going through a hard time, could be anything, to find something good
mm-hmm.
for them to hold on to. Like I think when I look at my brother and myself and my older brother and what the differences of three kids in the same household. And I think it was, I was good at school.
Mm-hmm.
I liked sports. I had a good friend group. Because to be fair, I could easily go on the other way, like very easily. Right. And I know that about myself because I just knew that I had that in me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, because I knew my risk factors, right? And I feel like that really did make a difference mm-hmm. for me. Because of my brother, oddly, being 14 months younger than me, became an addict before me.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of was like, I don't want to do that. So I think if you find something with like motivational interviewing,
mm-hmm.
right? Finding people's strengths, finding something to build them up,
mm-hmm.
right? To have them lean on and having something positive outside of whatever it is that's negative or bringing them down or making them feel uncomfortable. I think is a good thing to do, you know,
almost like hope and purpose, giving them right. a sense of hope and purpose. And,
yeah. Like hope, purpose, yeah. or something they enjoy. That's an escape from yes. the things that's maybe not so enjoyable.
Yes.
Right. And, or having a coping skill, like a sport or a club or, a religion.
A
it could be anything
yes.
that's outside of that. If this part of your life isn't going great, I could go to over here,
mm-hmm.
you know, or I could go to this person or I could go to this activity that makes you feel good. And I think that's the important part because I think my brother never found that. He liked four-wheeling, but that's not something you could do all year.
Also boredom. They said yes. that the kids need to know how to be bored.
How to be bored.
Yes, because yes. when they don't know how to be bored, the easy thing to do, especially when there's vapes and mm. marijuana and gummies and stuff.
Yeah.
It can be an easy coping Escape. Skill. Where can people find you? I know you're pretty full in your private practice, but if they wanted to find you to be a therapist for their young person, where can they find you?
So I'm on Psychology Today. I have a profile on there that you can contact me through. And even if I'm full, if you just want to talk or share or ask for information or resources, you can contact me on there.
Well, thank you, Michelle. I know we weren't sure how this episode was going to roll out. And thank you for trusting me and coming on the show and talking about your brother and family. And I'm so glad that I was able to ask you questions and just show the world what a wonderful person you are and why you're one of my best friends.
Aw, well, and I also want people to know out there that my brother was a very, very special soul. Like he wasn't just different in how he presented with like speaking or things like that. He was strikingly different. He had bright white blonde hair and dark tan skin and green eyes. And he just was so sweet and so special growing up that he always got attention everywhere we went. Like, oh, who's your, you know, who's that kid? He's so cute. And he would have given, and he did actually many times, the shirt off his back to people at the clinic or other people that were struggling. He'd take clothes to the clinic and give them out to people or food or money. He was just so caring. And I just feel like the world felt too much for him. Like he just couldn't cope with it. And without the services or support to teach him young, like how to deal with that, it just, substances became the way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it evolves and it changes. You know, it's like whack-a-mole. You fix one problem and another one pops up and it just kind of snowballs. So, but he was brilliant and he was very smart. He could tell you all the facts of everything. You know, it can happen to anybody,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you said I'm a good person. Well, I'm a good person because of him.
Mm-hmm.
And he made me who I am and taught me who I am. And through him, you know, I do this job to help others. So, you know, without him, I wouldn't be who I am.
Okay. On that note, thank you so much. Before we go, Aurora Healing Crew, take a deep breath like you're soaking in sunlight. Warm, steady, grounding. As you move through your day, check in with your gut. Notice how you feel around others. Your energy is precious. Protect it so you have the strength and light to do what really matters to you. Because life is hard, and we're getting through it together. Thank you for listening to the Aurora Sessions Beyond the Couch. Visit our website at aurorasuncounseling.com to learn more. You can find us on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube. Just search Aurora Sun Counseling. Got questions or topics you'd love to hear us cover? Email us at info@aurorasuncounseling.com or drop a comment. We'd love to hear from you.